oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060089, City of Waco versus Robert Lopez from Limestone County in the 10th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 060416, In re Columbia Medical Center of Las Colinas and others, an original proceeding. And docket number 060491, In re Baylor Medical Center at Garland, also an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments and will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to complete them all well before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060089, City of Waco versus Robert Lopez.
Wade will present argument for the petitioner. Has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez asserted a claim, the gravamen of which, and which from all sides, is an employment discrimination claim, a claim which falls squarely within the confines of Chapter 21 of the Labor Code. And yet, for some reason that's not entirely clear, he dressed it up and cloaked it as a whistleblower claim. This court has held in UT Southwestern versus Lutzenheiser that if a claimant wishes to enjoy the sovereign immunity of a particular statute, it must plead itself within the strict confines of that statute. In this instance, Mr. Lopez did not do that because, again, he has attempted to dress up an employment discrimination claim as a whistleblower claim, and in doing so has failed to put himself within the strict confines of the whistleblower statute, hence the plea to the jurisdiction, and hence why we are here considering whether or not he could do that.
Could Mr. Lopez allege a claim just under the policy itself without trying to do whistleblower? I mean, the Human Rights Act seems to contemplate that you can file a separate action under a local statute or ordinance.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that he could do that because, in fact, Chapter 21 is the exclusive remedy that's available to assert employment discrimination claims.
But doesn't it have a piece that says
the election of remedies?
Yes, sue under other law or an order or ordinance of a political subdivision.
Your Honor, yes, there is the election of remedies provision. What that does, however, there are two types of election of remedies provisions. One of them is it indicates that you have a choice. You can choose A or B. Another type of election of remedies provision, like exists in the Tort Claims Act, is it is a collateral estoppel. It basically puts you on notice that if you bring this, there is only one way to bring this, and if you bring this the wrong way, you forever lose your right to sue and you are forever foreclosed. That is the nature of the election of remedies provision here. It certainly does provide that there are other laws that may be provided by a local governmental entity, but they do not supplant, they do not take the place of, and they do not provide a basis for bringing a lawsuit in a court of the state of Texas in lieu of proceeding under Chapter 21.
What remedies are possible if somebody chooses to sue only under the manual or the EEO policy of the city, you know, not the act? And what remedies are possible if they try to sue under the policy?
Well, it could have been that some litigants might have thought that intentional infliction of emotional distress would provide the basis, but I think this court has pretty well foreclosed that. But there are certainly other types of claims which might be available of a common law nature. Those are certainly more limited when the defendant is a governmental entity because of the sovereign immunity, but there are certainly some instances or some causes of action that might be asserted. There might be an instance where a person would assert fraud or assault and battery or some other claim which in fact is at its heart or certainly connected to an employment discrimination claim. But that doesn't change the fact that if it is at its base and an employment discrimination claim that the exclusive remedy is under Chapter 21 and in the Labor Code. There is a comprehensive administrative review system that's been established by the Texas legislature for addressing these types of claims. The reason for that is that there are strong policy considerations that are associated with requiring people to use the scheme that has been established. There is that those policies are mediation, conciliation, and resolution before there is a lawsuit. That is why, as an entrance, before you can even get into court, you have got to exhaust those administrative requirements before you can sue. Of course, Chapter 21 is intended to carry out and affect the policies of Title VII. That's the very first purpose that's listed in Chapter 21. It's to affect the policies of Title VII. And therefore, this court and courts of the state of Texas are permitted to look to federal authority to determine or to provide guidance. If you look at the Fifth Circuit, what it says repeatedly is that, in fact, Title VII is the exclusive remedy for employment discrimination claims. There's a case decided by the Fifth Circuit, Jackson versus the City of Atlanta. In that case, a fire chief attempted to sue. He brought an employment discrimination claim. That's cited at 73 F3rd 60. He brought an employment discrimination claim, and what the court held in that case is he could not assert that claim under the 14th Amendment or Section 1983 because Title VII provided the exclusive remedy.
But the Human Rights Act in Texas doesn't have a provision analogous to that.
The Human Rights...
The Texas Act has no exclusivity provision like Title VII does in the Act itself.
That notwithstanding, the policy considerations are certainly the very same. The comprehensive nature of the scheme is very much the same.
But we feel a lot more comfortable when the legislature says this is the exclusive act. We don't care about policy. If they don't say that, shouldn't we feel less comfortable about saying, well, we'll say it then?
The federal courts that have looked at the labor code have considered that and contemplated that, and what they indicate is the policy of Title VII, not just based on, and certainly they look to the express language there, but separate and apart from that, the policy based on the comprehensive nature, based on the conciliation principles and indications are certainly consistent with and provide for having that be the exclusive remedy, and to the extent that Chapter 21 is intended to affect the policies of Title VII, it's entirely consistent with that and appropriate for this court to say that it is, in fact, the exclusive remedy. In the Lukowski versus James case, which was decided by the Fifth Circuit in 1995, that involved a professor who was seeking tenure. She was denied tenure, and she brought a suit under Title IX and Section 1983 only. She did not assert a claim under Title VII. The court held that her failure to do that was critical to its resolution in that case, and what it held was, notwithstanding her failure to invoke Title VII, her exclusive remedy lay under Title VII. And they said that in this case, the plaintiff was clearly attempting to circumvent the exclusive remedy that is established by Title VII, and it held that it was not going to allow her to disrupt the carefully balanced remedial scheme that had been established, and it also held that to allow her to circumvent that and get around it by asserting what was really an employment discrimination claim as a Title IX claim would do violence to the congressionally mandated procedures. What is significant about that is, in that case, the court determined that the exclusivity does not turn upon whether or not the litigant invokes Title VII, irrespective of their filing a claim through the administrative process. Title VII and Chapter 21 is the exclusive remedy. It does not turn on whether or not the litigant chooses to avail themselves of it in the first instance.
Let's assume for a minute that it's not exclusive. Explain why the policy passed by the City Council is not a rule passed under a statute.
The policy is just that. It is a policy that was passed by resolution. A rule is something that is directive. It is a command. It tells you precisely what to do. It does not create due process concerns in terms of, I don't know what this means, which is a policy is something that's aspirational. It's a goal. It's something that we would all like to aspire to. It is not something that establishes a bright line rule. If you have a policy And that in and of itself provides a basis for a claim under the Whistleblower Act. I'm sorry, were you about to? I didn't want to interrupt you. Okay. Then what you have, again, is you have a circumstance where you don't really know what the parameters are, and there's absolutely no limit to what the Whistleblower Act accomplishes. What that provision of the whistleblower statute provides, I think, where it says a rule under a statute or ordinance, what that's directed at is circumstances where you still have a bright-line rule, but say, for example, you have a city that sets up a commission, and the commission is made up of citizens, and they are allowed to, or a panel of people, and they are allowed to establish rules for governing, like a building code or construction, and so they have a rule that says you can't have dynamite or explosives on a work site. That is a rule that's covered. A policy is not covered. A resolution is not covered, because, again, that's not a bright-line rule. That's not a directive. That's not a command. There are no consequences to that.
Along some part of that spectrum, one bleeds into the other. Rule versus policy, policy versus rule. Is that a case-by-case analysis, or is there a bright line you think we can draw?
That is not a case-by-case analysis. That's precisely what you want to avoid. The rule that was pronounced by the 10th Court creates that, which is utter chaos and completely difficult to administer. What you look at, you do not look at the body or how the body that made the rule or the thing came into existence. That is not what the statute provides for. What you look at is whether or not it's a law, whether or not it's a rule, whether or not it's a directive, whether or not it has consequences. If it establishes a bright-line rule, then it would be a law for purposes of the Whistleblower Act. If it is something that says, we'd like to have a green city, or we would like to have a particular dress code, or there are certain things that we aspire to, that is not a law which can form the basis of a whistleblower claim. You can look at pretty much every rule that there is. For example, the Code of Judicial Conduct, you look at that, and it says it sets out standards and guidelines for conduct. It says that judges must be courteous and polite and treat litigants fairly. Well, surely, that's aspirational. If you have a briefing attorney who participates or is present and they say, boy, I think the judge was rude to that particular person, now, under this idea that a policy can form the basis of a whistleblower act, you now have a briefing attorney who, because they made this comment or this complaint, is now ensconced in the protections of the Whistleblower Act. Clearly, that's not what was intended, but that is what you have if you take the position that a policy can provide the basis for a whistleblower claim.
But a breach of a policy can create a grievable situation. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree that it could provide a grievable situation.
And so someone who reports grievable conduct and then is terminated for it, you say that's not a whistleblower situation.
What would provide the basis for determination of an employment dispute or a grievance in an employment setting is not something that should necessarily also provide the basis for bringing a whistleblower claim and a lawsuit against an employer. As this court noted in Hart, you have to have a balance. You have to have a balance between encouraging people to police themselves internally and then also being able to maintain some order and some discipline in the workplace.
But what if the policy forbids blatant discrimination and an employee witnesses someone fired solely on the basis of his or her race, and that employee is then terminated? It's in a policy of the city, but it is directed at a lawful command that there shall not be discrimination in Title VII and common law elsewhere. Why wouldn't that sort of conduct give rise to a whistleblower complaint?
Because that speaks directly to, that is provided for and taken care of by 21.055 of the Texas Labor Code, which provides protection for retaliation.
Well, we've moved beyond, we're now assuming, just for purposes of argument, that we think that there's an election of remedies and there's an ability to pursue a whistleblower claim. So the question is this a law, since it was adopted by City Council through pretty formal procedures? And so if we're in that scenario, why wouldn't someone being fired for reporting blatant discrimination not be subject to a whistleblower claim?
Again, because there is a remedy that is available for that. And the problem that arises is if you say that a policy, and we can say in this particular instance that ought to be okay, but then the rule eats up the circumstance. If you let someone be protected under the Whistleblower Act for reporting a policy in every instance, then what the Whistleblower Act requires as a general proposition is, as a fundamental element, is that you reach outside of it to report it to an appropriate law enforcement authority, you do that in good faith, and that there be an actual violation of law. If an internal policy qualifies for that, basically the requirements that were set out by this court in Needham are done away with, because if it's a policy, there's not a struggle over whether or not they believed in good faith it was a law, because of course it's a law. It's in my employment handbook. And as it relates to whether or not I reported to an appropriate law enforcement authority, there's no test there either, because of course I reported it to an appropriate person because it's in my handbook, and I reported it to somebody who works here. And there's case after case that says reporting it internally is not sufficient, because you want to have that balance. Certainly you do want to encourage people to police themselves internally, but you don't want to create a situation where everything constitutes a whistleblower claim.
Talk about the appropriate law enforcement authority piece of the law, because the Chief Justice Gray below based his entire dissent on that part of the test.
My time is up. May I continue?
You may answer.
Fine with me if it's okay with the Chief.
An appropriate law enforcement authority has certainly been spoken to repeatedly, and what it requires is someone who doesn't just have general enforcement authority, somebody who has general policing authority, but it's somebody who has the ability to take specific action on that act. As the court noted in DiIorio, what is required is not an internal HR person, but somebody who has the ability to take specific enforcement action. And again, if you do away with the requirement that it be a law, something that is a rule and bright line, and it's only based on this city has decided to adopt a policy, then the effect of that is that there is no external element. There's no gate. There's no vetting associated with the Whistleblower Act, because, of course, if it's in the employment manual, or here's what the mayor said, or here's what the city council member said, then everybody is an appropriate law enforcement authority to enforce that internal rule, and you've completely eaten up and done away with the Whistleblower Act.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Mr. Culler will present argument for the respondent.
If it pleases the court, I'd like to start with making sure we understand the basic facts of this case. Mr. Lopez, on August 20th, 2001, filed a grievance under the EEO policy. He filed that grievance with the EEO officer, the person that the city had designated as the individual to ride herd on these EEO grievances that it had passed. He alleged that his supervisor had engaged in race and age discrimination. Before September 10th, 2001, Mr. Lopez had been returned to his position as chief plumbing inspector of the city of Waco. His grievance under the EEO policy was complete. Prior to September 10th, 2001, the day he drove a city vehicle, to Austin for a state plumbing board meeting. The next day, on September 11th, he was told he was in trouble because he had taken that car without permission of his supervisor, the person that he had reported as being engaging in discrimination, and against whom Mr. Lopez's grievance had been resolved in Mr. Lopez's favor. So that's the basic facts of what we've got. Less than a month later, Mr. Lopez was terminated. It's clear in this case that the Texas Whistleblower Act waives the sovereign immunity of the city. The city started out this case by filing not a plea to the jurisdiction, but a motion for summary judgment.
What do you gain by filing it as a whistleblower action rather than a retaliation under the Human Rights Act?
Mr. Justice, what we believe is that was the only way that we could proceed, because Mr. Lopez had not opposed discrimination under the labor code. If you look at the labor code...
Mr. Lopez had not opposed discrimination?
He had opposed it under the EEO policy of the city, which is a rule, a law, that had been adopted pursuant to statute. That's where he opposed it. He had not opposed it under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act.
But he could have.
He could have.
And Title VII as well.
And Title VII as well.
Obviously, and where we're trying to decide here whether people have two options or one option, we're trying not to give people the wrong incentives. What do you gain by doing it under the Whistleblower Act? Damages different?
Damages are less. Actually, the caps under the Whistleblower Act are less than under the Texas Commission on Human Rights. The Whistleblower Act does, in fact, have a grievance procedure. Employees who are discriminated against or who are retaliated against under the Whistleblower Act have to file an appeal, a grievance. If there is a system there, they have to do that. Mr. Lopez pleaded that he had exhausted any applicable grievance system. So you have to do essentially the same thing. The way we looked at it, under the plain language of the statute, not having opposed the discrimination under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, that retaliation provision was questionable as to whether it was there. We believe that the more clear, the more direct statute dealing with this was, in fact, the Whistleblower Act.
How would we harm plaintiffs in any respect and who have legitimate claims if we were to hold that these sorts of claims must be filed with the Human Rights Commission and the lawsuit pursued under that act rather than a Whistleblower Act?
Well, I think that what would be happening in that case is that this court would, in fact, be legislating.
I understand that, and that's a legitimate point, but what I'm trying to get at is how would that harm the public in any way? The Human Rights Commission is set up to handle precisely these sorts of age discrimination, race discrimination claims. There's a very comprehensive administrative scheme. If that were to be the holding, and I understand you would object to that, but if that were to be the holding, how would that harm the public?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure exactly how that reaches everyone, but in this specific case, the facts of this case are such that you have to look at what was going on here. The discrimination complaint was resolved. It was completely over. All we're talking about here is retaliation.
So I'm taking it that the answer is it has no impact one way or the other.
It certainly has an impact in this case, and, Your Honor, I don't know that I've particularly thought.
I'm saying if we were to hold that the exclusive remedy is the Human Rights Commission, your client loses under those facts, then forget about your client. In the future, how does that impact other plaintiffs who make valid racial or age discrimination claims?
It would not if they're acting under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. The problem that we have is that you...
But I don't understand that answer. It would not if... Who's acting under the...
If the person who's made the complaint is acting under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, the way that you act under...
Doesn't act under anything. I don't understand that. He just does what he does.
Well, we're talking... And I think this is where there may be some confusion. We have to set aside the age and the race discrimination from the act of the retaliation, the age and race discrimination.
Fine. The retaliation section of the Human Rights Act doesn't say if you were unsuccessful and then retaliated against.
Yes.
I mean, it certainly applies if you were successful in your race claim and got reinstated, as Ms. Lopez did, and then they fire you because you did this. There's no question that's covered by the Human Rights Act.
And we have addressed in the brief the difference between the Title VII anti-retaliation provision and the Texas Commission on Human Rights anti-retaliation provision. In Title VII, it has both an oppositional clause that gives you protection if you oppose anything made illegal under this statute, and then it gives protection for actually filing the complaint and other things. The Texas Commission on Human Rights Act does not use the same structure. It says that it provides protection to anyone who, under this act, opposes discrimination. Well, the way, and Mr. Justice Heck, the way I was trying to get to this, the way that you oppose discrimination under the Act is to file a complaint.
Which he did.
He did not file it under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. He filed it under the city's EEO policy, which is where we are saying that is a law by definition of the statute. The law, the Whistleblower Act, specifically defines what a law is. This EEO policy was a law, and it says, it because it was adopted by the city acting under a statute. And because of that, that's separate from the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. And I would submit to you that the brief describes better the differences between Texas Commission on Human Rights Act and the Title VII oppositional language and how one can be confusing.
But that's premised on the notion that if you proceed under the EEO policy, you're locked into that avenue and cannot pursue a retaliatory claim under the Human Rights Act. That was your fear, that if you filed under the Human Rights Act for retaliation, that you'd get thrown out because you didn't initially proceed under the Human Rights Act tract.
That's exactly correct. We had not filed under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act and weren't confident that we had protection there.
But let me follow that through, and I think it's driving some of the questions here on the bench. If that were not an issue, if because the Human Rights Act allows by local ordinance for you to pursue other claims if there are other policies in place, or not policies but ordinance or something like that, if we were to say that proceeding along that path does not preclude you from pursuing a Human Rights Act retaliatory discharge claim, then the issues you're worried about would go away and there'd be no reason not to make the Human Rights Act the exclusive remedy.
I think that may be true. But that's not what we had in this case, and what we have to deal with in this case are the facts of this case.
Respond to Judge Gray's dissent, if you would.
Judge Gray's dissent looks at law enforcement authority.
And which prong do you say you're relying on the good faith, but good faith in which prong of the definition of law enforcement authority?
Well, we
certainly not to investigate and prosecute criminal law.
No, sir. Let me turn to that.
That leaves regulate under or enforce the law.
Regulate under or enforce is exactly what the EEO officer.
What kind of regulations could the EEO officer issue?
If you look at the EEO policy, there's actually a letter that's attached that the EEO officer submits or issues as soon as he receives the complaint. The EEO officer in the city of Waco is a person who rides herd on these complaints. He makes sure...
Rides herd's not in the statute. I need regulates or enforces. Do you claim that he regulates, he or she regulates?
He does enforce the time provisions.
But you don't claim that they regulate?
Well, there may be some regulation, but I can certainly go with enforces.
Okay. And the person enforces the law by doing what?
By sending the letter to the supervisor saying that you've had a complaint filed in your department. You've got 10 days in which to answer this complaint, making sure that each level of the system, of the grievance procedure, is addressed, and then accepting the any further appeals of the employee, bringing together a commission. There is actually a commission that can come to good.
Let's get together and talk about this. I understand that. Now, what can that EEO officer do? Can they fire somebody?
No, the EEO officer cannot.
Can they demote somebody?
No.
Can they cut their pay? What can they do to enforce the law?
They can, in fact, make sure that the city follows the policy. He is charged with that job.
How? Sending letters around and talking to people? What can he or she do?
Ultimately he can take it back to either the city council or to the city manager if it's not being followed.
Said in Needham, that's not enough.
Right.
If you, you know, handle the internal procedures and then report it to somebody else to enforce, that's not in force.
And that's where Needham comes into play, because Needham talks about the good faith prong. And it says in Needham that even if the employee is wrong, if the employee had a good faith belief.
So what did your client say he believed the EEO officer could do?
And we've set forth a specific testimony in the brief in this section.
Did he say he thought the EEO officer could fire the supervisor or demote him?
No, sir. What he said was that he had been told in a meeting that the way to report this was to take it to the EEO officer, to take the grievance to the EEO officer. He had been told that in a citywide employee meeting. He had been told that in a meeting with his supervisor.
What if they told Needham to take it to the internal disciplinary officer? Think Needham would have come out differently?
If the facts of Needham had raised that issue, if there was a fact issue in Needham about the good faith, and you have to address that good faith issue when you're dealing with a plea to the jurisdiction.
Can the EEO officer issue formal findings of discrimination analogous to a good cause determination like the Human Rights Commission or EEOC?
Not under this particular policy.
Can the officer mandate some sort of corrective action on behalf of the city, take this action or take that action in response to the allegation of discrimination?
No, sir, not under this policy. But under this policy, and the way it had been described to my client, he was told that this was the way you file it. He believed that they were, in fact.
I'm wondering how far this is going to go, though. What if, under your argument, won't it be true that every pay dispute, every dispute any employee will have, every labor dispute, they didn't pay me for overtime. And let's assume that the overtime cities has overtime policies adopted pursuant to statute and under ordinances, and you didn't pay me overtime. They give him the overtime and then fire him. Well, that's a whistleblower.
Well, he has reported a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. It certainly would be. I'm not sure that's...
So you're just to be clear with everybody where we're going. Where we're going is the Whistleblower Act is going to cover all employee disputes in all governments in the state.
Well, no, sir.
How are we going to stop them?
Well, the way we stop that is we say where a governmental employee opposes an action under a rule or policy adopted under a statute or ordinance, then if he meets the definition, if what he has opposed meets the definition of the law, he's protected under the Whistleblower Act. This idea of being protected has been overplayed and overblown here. Most nearly everyone in this room is in a protected classification because of age or race or gender or something anyway. The vast majority of the people who work for governmental entities are already in a protected classification.
But the authorizing acts for cities to do things are pretty broad.
Yes.
And there's going to be lots of little things like overtime pay and much smaller that are going to be adopted policies under a statute. The person thinks they're not getting what they want. Do we really want all of those becoming? Is that what we meant when the legislature said these are whistleblowers? Somebody come in and say you didn't pay me a half hour for my overtime. That's the whistleblowing the legislature wanted to encourage?
I don't believe that would be.
It can't possibly be. How are we going to keep that out?
What they wanted was to prevent somebody from retaliating. So why is somebody going to retaliate against someone? And that's where we get to really causation. I mean, just because an employee is elevated to a protected classification for having reported a pay issue that may be violative of the Fair Labor Standards Act, just because he is in that protected classification doesn't mean you're going to get a lawsuit. You have to have someone retaliate. You have to be able to connect everything. You have to show the nexus between the adverse employment action and the whistleblowing. So you don't always get there. And that's why I say, with all due respect, Mr. Justice, that I think that they have overplayed this issue, because there are lots of people who are in protected classifications and nothing bad happens to them. You have to have the bad act of retaliation, which is one of the two principles for which the Whistleblower Act was adopted.
Is this the need to establish a good faith belief that the officer could have regulated or enforced discrimination laws? Is that part of the Human Rights Commission as well? A part of the burden that the plaintiff has to show?
No, sir.
So if so, in some circumstances, it might be easier for them to get relief under the Human Rights Act than under the Whistleblower Act.
It certainly could, and Your Honor, I think there may be others that I just had not thought of before you asked that question earlier. But what it boils down to is we have a statute. We have the legislature has given us the definition of what a law is. And this court has written previously that if we're given a statutory definition, we can't add words to that. We can't go beyond the statutory definition of what a law is in the Whistleblower Act. It's been 12 years since the Whistleblower Act was amended by the legislature. In those 12 years, the city and its friends in this court have not been able to get the legislature to change that definition. This case was sitting there prior to the 2007 session. The legislature did not choose, and of course, we're supposed to assume that the legislature knows how the courts are interpreting its statutes. And in 2007, during that session, the legislature didn't come back and say, 10th Court of Appeals, you were wrong in how you interpreted our statute. And so, Your Honors, basically,
do you have any idea how often the legislature responds to the Court of Appeals?
I do know how often they respond to the Texas Municipal League, the Texas Association of School Boards, and the friends who are appearing with the city of Waco here today. And that is very often. And they have chosen not to do so in this case. This was not an exclusive matter just for the Texas Commission on Human Rights to look at.
Let me get straight on the facts. The transfer occurred, and how long after the transfer was the grievance filed?
He filed that within a matter of a day or two.
Then 4 days later, the transfer was reversed, and he was put back where he started.
Put back as the chief plumbing inspector, yes, sir. And so that's why we're saying that discrimination issue was over, but the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act is not the exclusive mode. In fact, it specifically says that it allows cities to adopt rules like the city of Waco did. The second thing is, this court, we are respectfully asking you not to amend the statute, to leave that to the legislature. They are inviting you to change the rules, to change the law, and we are asking you to uphold the 10th Court of Appeals opinion and allow this matter to finally get to trial.
The city's policy manual has a statement about retaliation, doesn't it?
It does.
And did he pursue his retaliation claim through, is there an exhaustion problem even internally?
No, there's really not even a mechanism that we could find for that. And we don't believe that that was required at that point to file it under that specific provision.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Amended takes us to a really good point in our argument, which is you're cherry picking, and what you're doing is you're modifying and making what is a comprehensive scheme intended for a specific purpose to be arbitrary and vary depending upon the facts and circumstances, and that ought not happen, that ought not occur.
Does the fact that Lopez proceeded under the EEO policy here rather than initially under the Human Rights Act preclude the later filing of a retaliatory claim under the Human Rights Act?
Absolutely not. For example, in Texas Department of Rehabilitative Services versus Abraham, in that case, the claimant made an internal complaint of sexual harassment. He hadn't made the complaint externally, and in that case, he brought a retaliation claim under Chapter 21, and it was held that, in fact, he was permitted to proceed with that because 21.055 protects exactly that type of conduct. The idea is that we want people to go through this process. We want people to report discrimination claims, whatever their genesis, race, sex, and if they do that and they are retaliated for that, they are protected under Chapter 21 without regard to whether or not they've actually invoked the formal process.
Let me ask you a procedural type question. Just assume that we disagree that the Human Rights Act is an exclusive remedy, so he could pursue a whistleblower act. But you had another ground in your plea to the jurisdiction, and that is the good faith reporting to an appropriate law enforcement agency. Assume we agree with you on that. Is that the proper subject of a plea to the jurisdiction? In other words, if you win on the good faith prong of your argument, does that mean the trial court loses jurisdiction, or is that more a matter for summary judgment?
Sovereign immunity operates as a shield in the absence of a waiver of that. If you have a claim for which sovereign immunity has not been appropriately invoked, then sovereign immunity stands and a court does not have jurisdiction of that matter. I know that there was a decision issued, I think, in June. It was the Ocala case where this very issue was considered, and the court said, we think that's a defensible matter and not a jurisdictional matter. Understanding that that's their view, I think you have to go back to what this court has said in terms of a litigant has to plead themselves into the waiver of sovereign immunity. And if their plea does not include a waiver of those components, which is that they have met the basic elements of the claim, then sovereign immunity still stands. And so it is an appropriate matter for jurisdiction because the trial court never obtains jurisdiction of the
matter. Let me go back.
I went first last time after you.
Thank you. Go back to Judge Brisker's question earlier to Mr. Culler about what incentives a claimant's lawyer might have to bring this under the Whistleblower Act as opposed to the Human Rights Act or EEO or Title VII. I mean, why would strategically a lawyer want to bring this under the Whistleblower Act? Are there any advantages to that?
I could opine on that. Frankly, I think Mr. Culler would be better equipped to answer that. But I would think you do get to court much more quickly. You get to court, and a huge advantage, which makes a big difference, is you come to court with a presumption that the thing that you're complaining about, in fact, was the cause of your disciplinary action. That is a huge advantage. What that does is that puts the city in the circumstance of having to prove, no, it wasn't that, but these other things. That's a presumption that goes through with them, and actually there's an instruction to the jury on that. That is a huge strategic advantage, and again, it is very counter and contrary to the idea of reconciliation, mediation, and resolving it. Another point is, yes, there is a provision in the whistleblower statute, an exhaustion requirement, which says that you have to go through the grievance process. That cannot be confused with the administrative and grievance process that's provided for under the Human Rights Act, because, in fact, there are lots of cities that don't even have a real grievance procedure. The grievance procedure and the appeal procedure consists of you go to the person who fired you and say, can I have my job back? And they say no, and then you're done, and you've exhausted that under the whistleblower. It certainly is not a substitute for that comprehensive system that's intended to make you go through a formal, protracted process so that we can resolve these
Is the city's
internally.
EEO office deemed a so-called deferral agency, or complaints filed with them are deemed filed under the Human Rights Act with the commission?
No, they are not. If the court adopts the decision of the 10th Court of Appeals, you are going to discourage cities from adopting policies. You're going to discourage the very type of activity that we ought to encourage. You're going to discourage cities from having resolutions supporting the Girl Scouts and the pudding festivals and all those other things, because then any violation of that, they didn't make pudding, is going to result in a whistleblower claim. I realize it sounds a little bit overblown, but that is really the reality. That's not a situation that we want to have. It's unmanageable, and we've asked the court to grant the pleaded jurisdiction. Thank you,
Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.